KBOO, Portland, Oregon.
I think there's some really fundamental differences in the way Joanne's looking at the world and that I do. I do not think we can have a successful city without a successful police department. Anytime you are giving someone a gun and you are sanctioning a form of state violence, that has to be subject to scrutiny, oversight, and accountability. Without question, I think all Portlanders would agree on that. But what Joanne has done with political rhetoric in this town and really embraced a very far extreme element of it, where the police can never do right, no matter what they do. They're damned if they do, they're damned if they don't. The worst assumptions are made about their motivations. They continue to be put into very difficult situations.
Hi, this is Peter Marks.
And this is Daniel Mulkey. Welcome to Rhythm Nation, a show and nonprofit organization that believes music communities can make change.
Today in the show, we have Renee Gonzalez, who's running for our last guest, Commissioner Joanne Hardesty's seat on the Portland City Council. Our hope is that with this interview, we can better inform voters about their options for city governance and also hear different perspectives on the most important issues facing our city.
Just taking a quick break in our interview to remind you that this is a great time to become a member of KBOO. Show your support for our program and for KBOO by becoming a KBOO member today. You can just go to kboo.fm/give, and there you can help us meet our goal of $45,000 for the end of this year. We're community funded, so we need your support to get there. Just go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321.
Renee, welcome to the show. Thanks for being here.
Thanks so much for having me.
What inspired you to run for this city council position?
Yeah, thanks. Well, my family's been here a long time. I've got relatives that go back all the way to the 19th century, off and on. And our city's at a tough spot in its history. You know, it's had good times and it's had some rough times. And certainly in my lifetime, I'm not sure it's had a rougher time than it's having right now. It was a little bit of, are you going to complain? Are you going to leave? Or are you going to try and fix it? Or contribute and be part of a team that will work to make it better and restore the things that were good about it before, but also help build a future that we can call kind of all unite around. And there's a little more texture there. So when COVID hit, schools shut down, sports were discontinued throughout the state. As the pandemic continued and we started to get more data about its impact on younger people, or, you know, lesser impact, for oversimplifying here, but less of an impact on younger people. We really got into some interesting policies, decisions around their access to school and sports. And I started a advocacy group in Portland last fall, really trying to get kids back on the field and back in school. That was a small group, about 2,000 people in Portland, unified with some folks statewide, got up to about 40,000 people statewide, trying to get people, just kids back on the field, kids back in school, and doing music, doing their other co-curricular activities. And once I went down that path, that got the attention of some folks that were kind of involved in politics, and they asked me to consider running for this seat. So it was, you know, kind of pulled two different ways into this race. One was just genuine concern about where we are, and also what we can be, and the difference between those two things. And then second, that there were folks who thought I could be a stabilizing voice for the city, and it was at a fight or flight kind of point in time. Do we stay here and fight and build, or do we raise our family somewhere else? So yeah, kind of those two different wins that brought me into the race.
So I'm really curious about the sort of behind the scenes, what's going on there. I think a lot of people that listen to the podcast are interested in sort of the process. Obviously you were doing this work with soccer in town and getting kids back and engaged. How does that go? How do you go from that to now I'm running for city commissioner? You know, who is approaching you? Who, you know, what does that look like for you? What does that, you know, yeah. What's, if you could just tell us a little bit more about the process.
Yeah, the texture there. Well, I mean, the thought was, I think, first of all, there are just a lot of families in the city of Portland that were drawn to a progressive city where you could bike and that had a functioning public school system and great parks and a beautiful river. And, you know, the joke about the dream of the 90s, you know, but we all kind of lived it, right? I mean, in our own way. And you know, it was a great place to start a career, and it was, but you also thought it was a great place to like raise a family. I mean, it was, and a lot of the same political establishment instincts associated with schools and associated with children's access to, we use a broad term, co-curricular activities, sports, music, dance, the arts, that a lot of the slow response to getting kids access to those things, I think we were seeing with a slow response to crime and the challenges of the unsheltered. And both of those topics have texture, right? Like we can get into those, but the way our political establishment was responding to both of these or each of those problems, a lot of folks saw parallels. So I started to get in some encouragement with just within the family communities that, look, getting people back in school, that was a controversial subject. It was a fight. It was a political fight. There's still elements associated with that right now, as you know, the school district and the teachers union negotiate on working conditions in the second part of the school year. I think some folks in the family community saw me as a leader there within Portland, encouraged me to apply some of those skills in to some of the city's broader problems. And then separately, there's folks that have just been around the city for a while in Portland politics that are, you know, they saw us have some success as a grassroots movement. And that was encouraging to them.
Well, it's a very like poetic illustration of a grassroots movement that originates on soccer fields. I think that's a very, very strong visual. So I want to talk about homelessness in Portland. It's an issue that's on a lot of front of a lot of folks' mind. You mentioned on your website that you describe eliminating the anything goes approach with respect to the unhoused. How do you specifically think the city should change course on this issue?
Yeah, sure. Well, it may overlap, I think, with some of the advocacy you've done in the past, Peter, right? Would you work on Measure 110? Did I read that somewhere?
Rhythm Nation as a group did, actually. Okay. A year ago, we were all involved with that campaign. Yeah.
So, you know, there's some interesting pieces there, but kind of maybe I'll start with some data, right? So last time Multnomah County did their study of the unsheltered and the homeless, 2019, we're hoping for a new one in 2022. They found, and I'm gonna speak in real broad terms, round numbers, roughly 4,000 by that count, homeless, roughly half of that unsheltered. And again, I'm rounding big, but so of the unsheltered, what we see in our parks and on our sidewalks, Multnomah County concluded almost 80% have some form of disability. And number one on the list was addiction. Number two on the list was mental illness. And then there's a lot of the unsheltered that have both, right? So, so when we look at root cause, the root causes of the unsheltered being in that predicament, often there's this sort of framing that it's economic upheaval, that it's financial problems. And it's often the way it's described. But when you're looking at that data, and again, I'm just literally quoting Multnomah County's numbers and rounding a little bit, you know, that is a really high percentage of folks struggling with addiction or mental illness. And, you know, you kind of dig into the data. Okay, so how do we address addiction? I mean, and, you know, and that's a broad topic in itself. Are we talking alcohol? Are we talking about opiates? Are we talking about meth? I mean, it may not all be the same approach there, but but within the recovered community, those who have fought addiction and been successful, one of their critiques often is that there has to be a catalyst, a trigger that makes someone choose to go and participate in addiction services, right? That they're in looking at Measure 110, which is, you know, had some very venerable drivers there. You know, part of it was that the criminal system is not always a great place to like drive, you know, addiction services in general, right? And we can unpack that. The flip side of that, though, is when you talk to recovering addicts, they often say, well, I had to have something. And sometimes it was a judge telling me, you're literally going to jail or you're going to addiction services. And I think all of us have this hope with Measure 110. We want to see these, you know, the addiction services come to fruition. I know we're still early in this kind of this first year. But when I say kind of that anything goes, that I think in our on our unsheltered camps outside right now, we are tolerating a level of access, kind of unfettered access to the chemicals that a lot of these addicts are, you know, prisoners to. And it's kind of a tough love concept, but I think what we are doing right now is deeply inhumane, right? You got an addict, unsheltered, and we're not doing much to interfere with their access to, and again, I'm talking about pieces that even post Measure 110 are, you know, violation of law. Selling meth outside is still against the law, right? I mean, that's the piece there is that the worst thing we can do is allow an addict unfettered access to the chemicals that they're a prisoner to, and that allowing them to shoot up in public, allowing sales to occur in public, are not the way we should be doing it. And, you know, I'm curious kind of, and, you know, as you guys were doing Measure 110, I mean, what you saw successful in other countries, like, you know, Amsterdam, you know, anyone who's been to Amsterdam, amazing place, amazing bike paths. But they've also had kind of a long history with, you know, decriminalizing drugs on the one hand, and also trying to figure out what they have to do as a society to also prevent the excesses of that, right? So it's, you know, they have been successful as a society, arguably, right? And with the decriminalizing drugs. And, but in looking at some of how they have approached it, they don't really tolerate people shooting up in a park, right? I mean, there's still a form of regulation around it's generally decriminalized, but it's not anything goes. And I saw great, I'd be happy to share it with you, a summary of what's just gone on in Lisbon, which decriminalized, I think, about 10 years ago. I'm trying to remember when Portugal went through their big decriminalization movement. And there's a really poignant kind of piece to that where, you know, again, describing, you know, if you're in Lisbon, you cannot shoot up heroin on a bench. In Lisbon, you will be dealing with the police in that situation. If an addict can't take care of themselves, right, and they're sleeping next to a road, a street, they're in a really precarious situation. And to allow them anything goes, I think it's leading to really inhumane outcomes right now.
You're listening to Rhythm Nation on KBOO Portland. My name is Peter Marks. Just taking a quick break in our interview to remind you that this is a great time to become a member of KBOO. Show your support for our program and for KBOO by becoming a KBOO member today. You can just go to kboo.fm/give, and there you can help us meet our goal of $45,000 for the end of this year. We're community funded, so we need your support to get there. Just go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321.
I guess I wonder what a sweep might look like, especially for a camp, what that might look like to you in practice and when that's justified versus when it isn't justified.
Yeah, you know, I think right now, so two other pieces when we look at the overall, the unsheltered and the homeless, right? I'm gonna get to your answer in a second, but is mental illness treatment. We still struggle with that as a state, and arguably we have for 50 years. I mean, not to go through the whole history, but we deinstitutionalized, which kind of, for good reasons, we all saw One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, right? I mean, you know, that there's a reason why deinstitutionalization was pushed, going back, you know, Reagan kind of accelerated, but it preceded him in some ways too. And then we kind of dumped that on the judicial system, and now we're in this sort of third, whatever today is and how we approach mental illness, and it leaves a lot to be desired, and that's also a factor here. So when we're talking about the homeless and unsheltered, I just want to be clear that that is a component that needs to be addressed maybe a little bit separately from addiction within the in the unsheltered. But I think, you know, at the end of the day, we have to the third piece. So the West Coast, California, Oregon, we've kind of gone with this housing first mentality, right? So we're investing a lot of money in long-term housing. And sort of what people forget is that's been the default perspective going back to the Bush administration. He was a big fan of housing first. It was largely adopted in Utah, and then some other countries really pushed this. But that takes a long time. That doesn't address our problems on the street right now. And so I think when we talk about your question, so getting to your question about what sweeps look like, we absolutely have to prioritize access to shelter right now. And our relative spend, again, in states like Oregon and California on shelter versus long-term housing, we have made a bigger bet on long-term housing versus emergency shelter. And again, it's under kind of the housing first philosophy. I think that is turning out to be a mistake. I think we have to offer everyone in Portland access to emergency shelter as soon as possible. Now, what that emergency shelter looks like is, you know, that may be designated areas where we provide you a tent or you can, you know, can camp. I mean, but there are rules associated with that. There's no illegal drug sales, there's no chop blocks, there's no illegal prostitution, and there's no illegal use of drugs there. And so I think, so the question of camps is that has to be a, you know, number one priority is offering that. And it may, you know, in the short term, it may be just overnight. And if you can leave your stuff in a designated camp, you know, storage area, but we prioritize emergency shelter in the short term over kind of the medium term housing. And that means if a camp is in a park or RV is illegally parked on the side of the road, or a camp is on a sidewalk, right? I mean, that is not, we're not talking a couple hours that you're camped there. You provide access to emergency shelter that night, and we enforce the law in Portland, which is that you're not allowed to sleep in a park. You're not allowed to sleep on the sidewalk. You know, we made some decisions that we would limit enforcement. And we, without getting too deep on the legal side, although you're a law student, but you know, we've got the Boise case and we've got the Oregon statute that codified it. And there are legal constraints around how you do that, but fundamentally, if you're offering a place to sleep, you likely comply with both the Ninth Circuit decision and Oregon law. then the next level is what as a society we think is humane in that situation, right? And I'm leaning towards where my heart is and where my mind is I end up in the same place. We prioritize offering everyone emergency shelter. That is number one priority, and it's not going to be perfect day one. And again, that may be just offering them a tent initially in a designated area where you have access to a bathroom and garbage, but that's not in the middle of a park. It's not self-designated. They don't, you know, it's not an independent group dictating where they're going to camp. That is a city or county designated area where they can, you know, where we can provide a level of social services, a level of infrastructure. Ideally, we get them out of camp and into, you know, some sort of a shelter that's more akin to a house or a communal facility. That's what it looks like to me.
Obviously, in particular, we're mostly concerned about, you talk about unsheltered, but in particular, the chronically homeless, right? People that have been out on the street for many years and, like you say, have a lot of addiction issues, mental health issues. My follow-up is, you talked about, you know, setting up tent cities and setting up different types of shelter, temporary shelter, emergency shelter, where there wouldn't be drugs. So that leads me to ask, I mean, what is the incentive then? How do you get people who are addicted to drugs to go to a shelter that doesn't allow drugs, that has all these requirements, that maybe they're if they have mental health issues, the shelter isn't prepared to deal with? You know, how do you allow for those things? I think in somewhere like Portugal or a lot of parts of Europe, if you go to a shelter, you become a part of the system as a homeless person struggling with drug, any kind of addiction, no matter what it is, they have resources. But you know, how do you get at this point, as city commissioner, how do you get people who are addicted to drugs to even consider that as a first? And then I have another question somewhat related, just about, you know, where are these tents going to be? Where are these places going to be? And are you concerned about consolidating poverty?
Yeah, I mean, the second, poverty and other conduct that goes with an unsheltered camp, but I'll get to that in a second. So, you know, I think that on the first question, what do you do with folks that do not want to avail themselves of the services that we provide, such as they are, right? And we can talk about the sufficiency and, you know, the allocation of resources. That's where the anything goes needs to end. So if you are an addict and you will not go to a sanctioned camp, and you are shooting up drugs in a park, you need to face the judicial system at that point. And that is the shift in mentality, I think, that Portland has not yet been willing to do effectively. And again, you go look at places like Amsterdam and Portugal. Amsterdam was where we are right now, maybe 25, 30 years ago. They had to make an adjustment because that libertarian skin, what folks want to do with their own bodies, there's a fundamental respect for that, right? I mean, it's and I think that's a piece of Oregon's legacy, and I'm aligned with those values fundamentally. I think a lot of Portlanders are, but when you cross the line where you can no longer take care of yourself because of addiction, and your behaviors are materially negatively impacting the people around you, and that's children in parks, it's senior citizens getting attacked on, you know, Eastside Esplanade, it's then you face the judicial system. And I include in that shooting up in public, selling drugs in public, defecating in public. Those are all prohibited under Portland law. We're just choosing not to enforce. That is harsh, don't get me wrong. There's a tough aspect of that, but if we are offering folks services and they refuse those services and are continuing to engage and act in behavior that is prescribed by society, it is no longer Portland's responsibility to tolerate that indefinitely, at least when we're talking about addiction. The another texture there, Daniel, that is this whole question, and because I actually get this question a lot, like, you know, Europe, socialized medicine does a much better job of taking care of everything. I mean, that's you know, a baseline assumption, right? I mean, in you know, I'm not sure I disagree with it, honestly. I mean, at a high level, I will say, even in the United States, there is a diversity of approaches on the homeless and the relative allocation of investment in shelter versus long-term housing. And you look at a place like New York versus places like Oregon and California. New York has, for a number of years, prioritized emergency shelter investment over longer-term housing for the homeless. That's just, that was their policy choice some years ago. They have stuck with that. And they have a much lower rate of unsheltered per 100,000 than California or Oregon does. And so that's the same size pie. That's not expanding the pie, right? That is taking whatever pie you have and making the decision on how we're going to allocate those dollars. As it relates to addiction services, you know, I think we need to see how Measure 110's funding sources really, how does that play out, right? So let's give this a little, that's a part that I do have hope there. I believed in I think I voted for Measure 110. I have to go look back, go think about that. I think I voted for it, but you know, is that going to lead to a more efficient, you know, distribution of addiction services, for lack of a better term? It hasn't come yet, but we're still super early. I have a level of hope there.
You're listening to Rhythm Nation on KBOO Portland. My name is Peter Marks. Just taking a quick break in our interview to remind you that this is a great time to become a member of KBOO. Show your support for our program and for KBOO by becoming a KBOO member today. You can just go to kboo.fm/give, and there you can help us meet our goal of $45,000 for the end of this year. We're community funded, so we need your support to get there. Just go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321.
So I wanted to chat about the police and how they fit into this. Presumably it's the police or some combination of the police and street response or some other organization that's going to be enforcing some of these rules or helping with that transition of camps on the sidewalk into areas where there's designated housing for folks going through that transition. You say on your website that you're making a call for a first class police department. Presumably that means, you know, more funding. This is a department that's had some budget cuts, but to my knowledge, it remains like the highest budget of any department in the city. So I'm wondering, like, in addition to funds, like what kinds of systems and accountability do we need to ensure that, like, this department successfully reduces both gun violence? We haven't really even talked about that. I mean, that's a huge issue right now in our city with the wave of historical gun violence. But how do we ensure that we don't end up back where we, in some ways, we were 18 months ago with this frustration towards our police and feeling like there's not like accountability in place? How do you balance those things?
Yeah, I think it's a tough balance. There's no two ways about it. And you know, taking a step back, you know, what are the drivers of crime? And clearly multifactorial, right? It's not one thing. It's not, and you go read kind of criminologists and they break down going over many decades in different cities, what leads to increases in crime and decreases in crime. And I never come away with a simple answer to what drives crime. It's not one piece. I think that however, going into a pandemic where we locked things down the way we did, I think we made a horrible mistake in cutting $15 million from the budget last year, and it's largely been restored. But I think that was a poor decision. It was a response to the moment. And I say that only because in a time of social strife, police on the streets is a stabilizing factor. It will not by itself be the way as a free society we want to address crime. I mean, we, you know, mass incarceration and policing our way out of our social ills, I don't think I'm not in favor of that. I don't think as a society we'll find a consensus in Portland that that is the way to address our social ills. But at a time of social strife and a time of anger and a time of, you know, social fabric being kind of torn apart, we have to have a police presence on the streets. And we are seeing some of the other very negative ramifications of the lack of that presence. I mean, one, it will drive flight to the suburbs. It will drive flight out of the city. But the people who stay, you see in the affluent, including our business community, will resort to privatization of police functions, which is already happening, you know, and people can complain about it, but to me, it's a rational outcome when you cannot find public police as a solution. I don't think it's a net positive for a society that we have to, that our wealthy are being driven, or our business community are being driven to privatize a lot of police functions because of the insufficiency of the public level, right? I mean, that means, you know, you want to talk about a class system, you'll have the wealthy protected by private police and everyone else fending for themselves or on a under, you know, relying on an underfunded police department. I think that is not the outcomes we want, but that is the path we started down when we cut 15 million at a time of, you know, great social strife. And then the third piece is the vigilante emergence, right? I mean, that you take away confidence that the public police force will provide you justice, will protect you, you lead to these other really unhealthy responses as a society. Again, privatization, I think that is a rational decision, that if you have the means, you would privatize your protections so you can protect your family or business. That's a rational decision for those group of players. It is not a net positive for the city of Portland if our wealthy will be forced or deemed forced to make that investment, or vigilantes. And so I, you know, that's kind of just looking at the last kind of 12 to 18 months. You know, we have to have a baseline of investment in police that it incurs confidence, that it does serve as a level of deterrent. I think sometimes the level of deterrent can be overstated, but I do think it plays a role. And a little texture there, but the elimination of the gang unit, elimination of the gun violence unit, totally opposed to that. I think it was a horrific decision. And even if the reasons for it were venerable, right? We were looking at over policing and super in some communities, and they pointed at the gun unit and the gang reduction unit as the folks doing the over policing, right? I mean, and oversimplifying, that was the thought. And what we have replaced over policing with is a epidemic of homicides in the Black and Brown communities in this city, right? So we traded over policing with homicides that are out of control. To me, that's not a rational trade. That was the wrong bet. And you can get into why those divisions work, but part of it is you have a set of police officers that know every gangbanger's by first name. They know their parents. They know what groups they're part of. They go to the funerals, and that in many cities has been concluded to be an effective way to address certain pieces of gang violence, particularly retaliation, right? You know, that is an effective tool in confronting that. So we cut dollars, we took away specialists at a time of social strife. I think that was a terrible, terrible mistake, somewhat being remedied right now in terms of overall dollars. But But let's take a step back more broadly about crime, right? So, you know, if we're as a free society, we do not want to be entirely reliant on mass incarceration and police to address crime. Police have a role, but what do we have to do? I think we need to return to some form of social fabric and protecting the social fabric. And that means as safely as we can, reopening as much as we can in the city, particularly if you're young. Look, if you're under 35 and you're vaccinated, particularly you're double vaxxed, I think we really need as policymakers to look, say, we need to get those people back in living, right? I mean, if you're relatively low risk for the, you know, we'll see whatever variant comes next. And we always, you know, can adjust our approach based on the latest data. But if you're young and healthy and you're vaccinated, we need to do everything we can to get you back playing sports, doing music, going to work, enjoying life. I think joy and life are a big crime preventer in themselves, and having connection, I think that's a big piece. And then economic opportunity, you know, I mean, we have a whole period of our life where we're all largely dependent on some sort of government intervention. And, you know, I'm a small business owner, and, you know, you had PPP money and, you know, folks that are participating in employment support. And that was a reasonable response to a very difficult pandemic. But we need folks to be able to get a job that can support themselves in the city. And that means that business isn't the enemy. That means folks that are creating jobs are part of what we need to welcome here. And we need to create an environment again where businesses can thrive. And that's whether it's a place where you go here, listen to live music. That's whether it's your bars and restaurants, all of whom have been devastated over the last 20 months and who employed a lot of people in this city, much less technology companies like, you know, the world you come from, Peter, the world I'm in, or law firms. And I think economic opportunity is absolutely a factor in reducing crime. And then, you know, I kind of hit on it, but reestablishing the social fabric and making that an end in itself, that people are going to soccer games in big numbers, they're participating in soccer games in big numbers, that we have live music, that we have movies in the park again as soon as possible, that people that are so inclined, if you're religious, get back in the temple and the church. Like, these are things that matter in addressing crime. And when we were at our most successful as a city there, people were engaging in those activities. So we need to restore. One last piece, Oregon legislature adopted over 20 pieces of police accountability legislation last year. And you asked a Democratic legislator, and you know, that's my party, I'm a Democrat, but what do all 20 things do? And you can never get an answer, right? I mean, there's nobody who can kind of like off the top of their head give you a comprehensive answer of what all 20 things were supposed to address and what outcomes are supposed to drive and how do we measure it. I think we need to take a little bit of a moment and let's see how those 20 pieces of legislation, what outcomes did it drive, what unintended consequences did it create, and then sort of reset. What further do we need to do? What did we just do that actually makes our city less safe? I mean, you know, there's a lot of pieces there. And let's just digest the data, because that was not little activity. That was a very progressive state legislature with no real ability of anyone in any police union to stop adopting over 20 pieces of legislation. Let's see what that did and what outcomes it's driving. And then as a city, we can adjust based on, you know, real informed data.
So I wanted to ask you a question that gets at, I think, the heart of this discussion. On our last episode, your opponent, the current city commissioner, Joanne Hardesty, she described the core problem in Portland as this struggle between an economic establishment who wants to uphold a status quo versus a lower income and traditionally marginalized groups of people who don't want to go back to the way things they were before. But to hear, you mentioned, you know, you want to see the social fabric of Portland restored. I got the sense from talking with Commissioner Hardesty that in her view, the social fabric in many ways was lacking in Portland and in a lot of respects, including in like the Portland Police Bureau, which she obviously has a lot of opinions on that and has, views like their struggles to hire, for example, as emblematic of some cultural problems there. So like on your Twitter bio, you present yourself as a centrist problem solver. And I think that's in some ways, I think that's like what a lot of people want to see, but you know, what would you say to someone who feels that like being a centrist problem solver is like akin to defending the status quo? Like how do you balance these things?
I would say sometimes being a centrist moderate means you're wishy-washy and trying to, you know, satisfy all sides in a way that doesn't really address issues. And that, you know, we can dive into that sometimes. I think it's the most appropriate description of me, but in terms of being centrist and moderate, that not playing to an ideological extreme and really focusing on problem solving, and I think, you know, nostalgia is never what it used to be, right? That's always true. But when you look at when Portland was successful, you had folks that were very much focused on city problems, city opportunities, and finding a way to solve that. And along the way, we became national leaders in some things, but I'm not sure we did that because we tried, you know, out of the gate, we were trying to be national leaders. We were trying to solve Portland's problems. You know, I think there's some really fundamental differences in the way Joanne's looking at the world and that I do. One, I do not think we can have a successful city without a successful police department. And a part of that, you know, she attributes our failure to recruit to cultural problems inside the police department. What rational parent would encourage their children to be a PPS police officer right now, given the degree of antipathy, the number of times people scream at them, spit on them, the general, what I would call defund culture, and I stole that from a blogger, by the way, that's not my own term, but defund culture that is in the city. I mean, you're treated with incredible scorn. You're always assumed, the worst is assumed out of you by a substantial part of the press. And as a city, we need a functioning police department. Anytime you are giving someone a gun and you are sanctioning a form of state violence, that has to be subject to scrutiny, oversight, and accountability. Without question, I think all Portlanders would agree on that. But what Joanne has done with political rhetoric in this town and really embraced a very far extreme element of it, where the police can never do right, no matter what they do. They're damned if they do, they're damned if they don't. The worst assumptions are made about their motivations. They continue to be put into very difficult situations. Again, you know, I use the example of the police officer who shot the homeless man that was approaching him with a screwdriver, right? You know, that was earlier this year, a very unfortunate death, right? He was, that police officer has to make a split second decision. And what people forget, and a fireman pointed this out to me about that situation, that police officer tried to de-escalate that situation multiple times. They tried to leave, right? And when that gentleman was coming at him with a screwdriver, there were three firemen behind that police officer. So that police officer is making a split second decision, and not only to protect himself, to protect three firemen behind him. And the way that narrative gets spun sometimes in the press and on social media, it that you assume the worst. You know, it initially got reported that the person shot was black, so you have 30 protesters out there immediately. That was factually incorrect. The police officer was black. The gentleman having a mental illness episode was white. I think really fundamentally we have to reset on our relationship with our police. And we are not going to get out of this, our crime problems and our social strife issues, without a positive relationship with our police department and constant demonization of them and constantly defunding or threatening defunding is not the way to do that. That doesn't mean they get every budget dollars they want. That's, you know, that has to be a public policy discussion. But I think her rhetoric has been deeply damaging. I would also say, you know, the discussion about equality just by itself, I'm going to approach this as city commissioner that I'm going to try and raise all boats. I think the last 20 months has been difficult for those on the lowest end of the economic spectrum to the highest end of the economic spectrum. Now, the highest end, they can go hang out in Black Butte for the 20 months, you know, so, but it's still not been a fun time to be a Portlander. And my goal is to try and raise the boat for everyone. I think sometimes our modern Portland political rhetoric of the last few years has been very focused on class resentment, race resentment. And my goal is to try and make the world in Portland better for everybody. And I don't think anyone at the lowest end of the economic spectrum would say that things have gotten better in the last 20 months with all that discussion around, you know, a lot of economic class and racial resentment kind of rhetoric.
You're listening to Rhythm Nation on KBOO Portland. My name is Peter Marks. Just taking a quick break in our interview to remind you that this is a great time to become a member of KBOO. Show your support for our program and for KBOO by becoming a KBOO member today. You can just go to kboo.fm/give, and there you can help us meet our goal of $45,000 for the end of this year. We're community funded, so we need your support to get there. Just go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321.
Yeah, I find it very interesting. I'm fascinated by this because you talk about the obvious shift in city culture, right? From maybe 20 years ago when things were, you know, rough and tumble, whatever, not great at idioms, but whatever it is, where it's like, we're gonna be very pragmatic and get these things done. And that sort of led to progressive policies. And now we're in this place where the city has shifted and we have become very progressive. And so some of the sort of national rhetoric around police reform are pretty mainstream to the extent where Commissioner Hardesty obviously is sort of the emblematic of that at this point. So I wonder, you know, how you reconcile that, how you reconcile, you know, claiming to come from the people of Portland and embody that spirit while you're sort of fighting against that spirit right now as it's currently, you know, manifesting. And you know, how do you change that? How do you change the idea, the city culture around police in response to police? I don't think that most Portlanders hate police. I don't think it's most Portlanders who are going off to, you know, PPB officers and yelling at them in the face. But, you know, what do you see as, you know, your role in shifting the city culture, and can you do that, and should you do that?
Yeah, so the city culture, I think for cities to thrive, or even just to tread water, kind of in the West right now, we're all being pulled. You know, the old expression was all politics is local, right? You know, that goes back for a long time. And there are a lot of political commentators who say that's no longer true, right? And all politics is national. So whatever discussion you're having in a city council meeting is always tied to some national debate now. And my inclination is to reject that to the maximum extent possible. And so that we define problems in terms of the opportunities and problems of our city. And that's the lens we apply to it. You know, I was deeply disappointed on the various, just to give an example, the various judicial decisions that have been made in the last month, right? We have the vigilante in Wisconsin. We have this other set of vigilantes in Georgia. I'm using that term over really broadly, but applying it in both cases. And every political leader in Portland and Oregon has to comment on a judicial decision made by juries in other states. And it's, you know, never with texture, never with context. Some of them don't know what the hell they're talking about, right? A jury of their peers made decisions, one that Portland Democrats agree with and another they disagree with. Well, those juries are applying a system of that, you know, this is our judicial system that we've inherited for hundreds of years. That was a jury of those individuals' peers that heard the facts before them, applied state law, and drew a conclusion. Why do Portland civic leaders, when we have all of our own problems to deal with, take the time to, you know, comment and think about and have press releases about something going on across the country? Well, they are, because everything's been made nationalized, and I think we need to redefine the issues. So, you know, more fundamentally, how do we, you know, I guess where I would probably rhetorically wrestle with you a little bit there, Daniel, is that I don't think that, given where we are at this point in time, that the majority of Portlanders think the police are the enemy. I do not think the majority of Portlanders want to defund the police further, right? I think that there is a level of appreciation by a majority of Portlanders that to have a successful city, we need to have a healthy police department. And, you know, what healthy means, I mean, there's a lot of texture there that we can get into. At the same time, we have a segment of our population that, you know, and you tell me the percentage, is that 15 to 30%? That self-define as, you know, very far left, not, you know, in, are they left of Bernie? I don't know if they're left of Bernie, but, you know, you've also got kind of the anarchist, you know, element that we've always had anarchists in Portland, by the way. That goes back 100 years. We've had our anarchists here a long time, but that, what do you do about that 10 to the 30? Well, I think, you know, one, be clear, I think the majority, you know, as I outlined, I don't think are with them, that I don't think the police are the enemy. And I also think we return some economic opportunity and social fabric to this city. And I think people chill out a little bit. You know, I mean, it's just go listen to music, go live a life, go build something beautiful, whether that's in a nonprofit or a startup, or a community organization. Let's go live again. And I think, I do think that chills people out, and maybe pop an edible too, just to, you know, to really chill out. But it's like, let's have a life again. And I do believe that some of the power and intensity of the political violence we've seen in the city over the past year plus, you know, it's not only attributable to being locked down, but it is partially attributable to lockdowns, right? I mean, it's not an either or. We saw horrific things on TV. We saw abuse of police power. We saw white on black crime that was awful to witness at a time when a lot of people were locked down and lacking social context. So what occurred in terms of the outpouring and intensity is understandable, is rational. I think in our hearts, we all recoiled at what we all saw, right? What triggered it. But the level of intensity and the length of the intensity, in my mind, is partially attributable that we did not have a functioning social fabric. We did not have other outlets for, you know, our other needs as humans.
That's so fair. I guess I just wonder how we get people to, you know, want to, I don't want to take up too much time with this either, but how we get people to actually apply for the police department when this is the case, right? When people are resigning because of abuse, you know, how do you as commissioner come in there and say, hey, here's a thing that we can do to restore some faith or to encourage people to apply or to try to do some public outreach? You know, what tangibly do you think you could actually do?
I think we need, you know, and it's probably I'm probably going to be the guy. We need a police department cheerleader, right? You know, Ted does a little bit of it now, but we need more thinking of the good cops, the folks that are putting their lives on the line every day. We need to glorify the good behaviors as much as we condemn the bad behaviors. And that is out of whack in the city of Portland right now. Not a solution in itself, but it's a piece of it. I will say one thing that Joanne has said recently that I agree with. I think we need police officers living in the city again. We need to find every way we can to encourage that. One of the worst stories I heard right at the beginning of the pandemic, I actually think it predates the pandemic, but we had a local high school terminate a police officer as a assistant football coach. And it was not because of anything this police officer had done. It was because of the environment and the views of police at the time in the community. They could attribute, there was no allegation he did anything wrong or that he wasn't the right guy for that. They did not want a police officer as an assistant football coach in the city. I think that is a really wrong path to go, right? I mean, for us to get out of this, we need as many connections and in context and being in the same community interactions we can have. And so it's not the police over here and the community over here, that we're all in the same community working together on how we're gonna, make Portland a better place.
Well, I really appreciated all the texture you've given us on that. Thank you so much for making the time to chat with us. I really appreciate how thoughtful you've been in your responses, and I think our listeners will really enjoy hearing your perspective on things.
Awesome.
Yeah, I really appreciate it. Thank you so much, Renee. Really, really appreciate it.
Cool. All good. Maybe next time we'll talk music too.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Rhythm Nation. We hope this has helped you better understand local issues and your options for city governance when you vote in May. If you have any thoughts on the candidates or the questions we asked, drop us an email at rhythmnationpdx@gmail.com or reach out to us at rhythmnationpdx on social media. Thanks. See you next time.
listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
KBOO radio station is located in Portland, Oregon, in Multnomah County. We honor the indigenous people whose traditional and ancestral homelands we stand on, the Multnomah, Kathlamet, Clackamas, Tumwater, Watlala bands of the Chinook, the Tualatin, Kalapuya, and many other indigenous nations of the Willamette and Columbia River regions. It is important to acknowledge the ancestors of this land and to recognize that we are here because of the sacrifices forced upon them. In remembering these communities, we honor their legacy, their lives, and their descendants with the forming of relationship to each other and the living world. We establish and support harmony within ourselves and set the stage for practice.
One, two, three, four.